everyone. Welcome to the Theology Mom podcast. This is a special edition that I have again for you this week. This is a live stream that I did over at the Center for Biblical Unity earlier in the week, where I was trying to do a little explainer video about an emerging stream within the pro-life movement called abolitionism. So I'm going to talk about this view and how it compares and contrasts with the mainstream pro-life view. I hope you find it helpful, and I do look forward to your feedback. And make sure to share this with a friend, a pastor, the elders in your church, to get clarity on this issue, because this is a viewpoint that is on the rise. And with that, here is the podcast. So today we're going to be talking about the pro-life movement. And one of the things that Monique and I have been noticing, and we've had some behind the scenes conversations about this, is that we are noticing kind of three streams within the pro-life movement that are starting to differentiate themselves. And I think that superficially, some people would say that these differences are largely about strategy. And while I do think strategy could be a part of some of the issues for the emergence of these different movements within the pro-life stream, I also think it's more than strategy, because some of the approaches that are emerging, you know, have attached to them certain moral principles on which they want to build laws and policies. So yes, there is a strategic component in these different streams of the pro-life movement, but I think it would be an oversimplification to say that this is the only difference is just merely one about strategies. So today we're going to be comparing and contrasting the kind of mainstream pro-life conversation and that stream with an emerging stream called the abolitionist movement. And and I'm going to give a definition here in a minute of what the abolitionist movement is. But we're going to watch a video together, and we're going to compare and contrast the two opposing positions. And I think it'll be very educational. My goal here when I always get on a family meeting is to just to try to teach you something, to try to help you engage better with the people around you and to be more knowledgeable and informed in the conversation, whether you're talking to Christians or non-Christians. So that's always my goal. Now, to be honest, I hadn't really heard of the abolitionist approach to the pro-life conversation until somewhat recently. And I came across a YouTube channel, and then I started watching that content and then started doing more research on it. Now, I'm not claiming to be an expert. I'm sure that there are some finer points of their position that I might get wrong, and I'm still just kind of early in my research, but I am trying to bring you some information about what I've learned so far. So if you have any feedback for me or corrections, feel free to send those my way, and I can try to incorporate that feedback into future conversations. But the bottom line of the abolitionist position is that, you know, they have in common with the mainstream pro-life position that the belief that all humans are created in the image of God. So I'm giving kind of the Christian version of the argument here. And so they want to take that all the way to its logical conclusion, that if we believe that abortion is murder, murder being defined as the unjustified taking of an innocent human life, that's my definition of murder, then they would say that if abortion is murder, and they would say that they would want to abolish all abortions, even chemical abortions, and by the part of the abolitionist label includes criminalizing participants in abortions.
such as doctors and nurses, perhaps people who sell chemical abortions through the mail, but also criminalizing or prosecuting the mothers involved. And that's sort of the controversial piece to their position. And we will unpack that today. But they often advocate for how this could be accomplished through the law courts by advocating for what they call equal protection laws. And so equal protection laws are intended to protect the life of the mother and to assign the same value to the preborn as the life of the mother. So that's kind of their position in a nutshell. Now, there are nuances within the stream, and you will find people advocating for other little positions, but this is the basic, as best as I understand it, big picture argument that they are wanting to make. Now, strategically speaking, many abolitionists also tend to take kind of this all or nothing strategy or posture. And so abolitionists tend to see things like heartbeat bills that help to diminish the number of abortions by saying you can't get an abortion if a heartbeat is present. So usually, my understanding, that's pretty early on in the process that a heartbeat is present. But abolitionists tend to see heartbeat bills as a form of compromise, because these bills still result in the death of the preborn, those without heartbeats. They would even, you know, want to include in the conversation in vitro fertilization and the life that is formed through that means. So we're going to play some clips to, again, try to compare and contrast and to learn more about the abolitionist position and comparing it to the standard pro-life position. I'm going to play some clips from an interview on the Extremely Pro-Life podcast with Kristen Hawkins. And she interviewed our friend Sam Say about the issue of abolition. Now, let me be clear. If you've ever seen Kristen Hawkins on Instagram, she's a woman with the most beautiful brown hair. And she is constantly being screamed at by college students, pro-choice college students, for taking a rather unapologetic position advocating for the lives of the preborn. And to be honest, I think the world would be in a better place if there were more people like Kristen Hawkins with that kind of courage going on college campuses and talking in public spaces. You know, she's been on CNN, and she'll go into any hostile environment, talk about life and advocating for the preborn. And I greatly and genuinely and sincerely admire her courage and her consistency. And so this is not a dunk video on Kristen Hawkins in any way. I'm just simply using this interview with Sam that she did because I thought it was so thoughtful. Nobody's yelling at each other. And hopefully we can learn from it. Hopefully we can learn from their conversation. And I think it offers an opportunity for thoughtful people to educate themselves about the differences between the standard pro-life position and the abolitionist position. And okay, Elaine is saying, thanks, Elaine. I wasn't really sure, like, how many weeks is a heartbeat detectable? I don't really know that number off the top of my head. So Elaine is saying a heartbeat is detectable sometimes as early as the first missed cycle. Yeah, I was thinking like maybe 6 weeks, but maybe too many weeks. I don't know. Maybe if somebody has that science, they can put it in the chat for me. So I do want to encourage you, if you're concerned that I'm taking anything out of context or whatever, you can go watch the video yourself. I always do my very best to try to represent people's positions fairly. If Sam or Kristen watch this video, I feel like I will have accomplished a lot if they watch it and they feel like I've done a fair job of representing their positions. So that's always my goal. Not to say I'm perfect at it, but that is always my goal. Okay, first up in this clip, we're going to hear Kristen Hawkins summarize some of her negative interactions with advocates of the abolitionist position.
But this abolitionism, this is something that we've seen at Students for Life kind of come up in the last few years where, you know, we'll have a student, we'll be working with a student, and then they'll be like, well, wait a minute, I can't support this piece of legislation. I can't work with you any longer because this bill will only save 99% of all children in the state. And therefore, I hate this bill and I'm going to tell everybody I know to vote against it. And you're like, wait, what? You're like this. If this bill gets passed and becomes a law, 99% of all children who would die from abortion would not die from abortion. But you're going to help those who support abortion kill this bill over that. And they're like, "Yep," and that's what God would tell me to do. So can you explain?
Okay, so I'm assuming here that she's talking about bills that will prevent 99% of abortions. I'm assuming she's talking about heartbeat bills. I'm a little bit of a skeptic as to how accurate the number is of 99%, because I doubt she's including chemical abortions in that. Usually those are not part of, from my understanding, chemical abortion is not included in the heartbeat bill. I could be wrong about that, but that was a question that kind of popped up in my mind when I heard what she said. But as you can see, her frustration in interacting with people who hold to the abolitionist viewpoint, they tend to sometimes be very black and white in their thinking. And so they, some of them will have a tendency to oppose heartbeat bills or other types of bills if they're not going to abolish all abortions everywhere universally. And they really see incremental approaches as some form of compromise to saving all of the preborn. Okay, let's continue now. And
maybe in a more reasonable way, me getting angry, the difference between like what is this new like abolitionism definition? Because like I said, at the beginning, I've always considered myself an abortion abolitionist. Like, duh, that's our goal, is to abolish abortion, to make abortion unavailable and unthinkable. Twofold goal in the pro-life movement. But now it's like, no, you're not an quote-unquote abolitionist if you believe, you know, or support or advocate for or tell a legislator to vote for legislation that doesn't 100% end all abortions immediately, even though there is no chance that that law would actually go into effect.
Yeah. So abolitionism is, at least this version of abolitionism, is about a decade old, maybe a little bit older than that, but it's about 10 years old. Mostly, I'm a Christian, but particularly abolitionism is coming from primarily anti-abortion Christians who believe in centralizing the gospel in pro-life advocacy or anti-abortion advocacy. I think so abolitionism means that you centralize the gospel, and then especially they're known for being immediatist. So abolitionism, when people usually mention it, at least in the pro-life aspect, they really mean the immediatist view, which is that the incrementalist view, as you've mentioned before, the incrementalist view of taking whatever you can get in terms of being able to push whatever law you can, even though it won't be perfect. A law that will save some babies, they think, is wrong. They think that it would, by nature, in their minds, it would sanction some abortions. So, for example, the heartbeat bills, they would say that it might save some people, but they would say that it, does the ends justify the means? Is it really okay in their minds, or in their words, to sanction the murder of some babies, even if you save some babies? That's really their argument. So they believe that you should be an immediatist, and that you should immediately call for all abortions to end with zero exceptions. And not just that, a very key part, not just that, is that to be truly immediatist, to truly want a truly anti-abortion bill, not only does it have to end all abortions with zero exceptions, which of course every truly pro-life person agrees that should be the goal, but also where there's strongest agreement on, where though I'm pro-life, many pro-life people disagree on me with this, but they would say that a truly good anti-abortion bill has to criminalize abortion, which would also then penalize anybody, including the abortive women, the abortionist, or anyone who facilitates an abortion, that they would want them to be penalized as well with murder charges.
Okay, so there you have it. Sam gives pretty good definition and overview of the abolitionist position. So go ahead and jump on the chat. If you have questions, you want to interact with all of this, feel free to put your questions there. I'll do my best to address them as we go along. Okay, now we're going to hear Kristen Hawkins' response to what Sam just said.
Interesting. Do they compare themselves to like William Wilberforce?
Yes, they absolutely do. They they say that.
But he was incrementalist.
Yeah. Now I completely agree with that. That's an argument that I
can you explain that? So everyone who's like, who the heck is William Wilberforce? Sorry.
So Wilberforce was a Christian politician in the UK in the 18th and 19th century, which would be the 1700s and the 1800s. When he became a Christian, he was very passionate about sin or against sin and against injustice, mm-hmm. especially slave trade or slavery as a whole. Mm-hmm. So what he wanted to do was to ban slavery as a whole in the British Empire. But he started off incrementally, as in gradually, pushing bills to ban mm-hmm. the slave trade. Yeah. Before that even passed, he would support bills to limit the size of, to limit the number of slaves that could be on ships. Mm-hmm. He would support bills that would limit the number of slaves that could be sold at shipping ports before he could finally end the slave trade. Mm-hmm. Now, they claim, abolitionists claim, that he was an abolitionist because he wanted to immediately end the slave trade. Well, yes, he wanted to immediately end the slave trade, but that's not all he wanted to do. He wanted to ban slavery as a whole, but he knew it was impossible at the time to ban slavery as a whole without first banning the slave trade.
I was just thinking of the slave ships that were coming into the ports there in the UK. Like, if you're an abolitionist.
Okay. All right. I'm going to pause it for a second. So basically, in describing William Wilberforce, and hopefully you know who William Wilberforce is, Sam gives a good little explanation of him there. But I would encourage you to go watch a movie from a number of years ago. It could have been 10 or 15 years ago now, called Amazing Grace, which is a little theatrical biography film that came out about the quest of William Wilberforce to try to abolish slavery in the UK. And he really had a radical conversion experience as a young man and wanted to basically abolish slavery, period. But he saw a pathway to doing that was to abolish the slave trade first. And he kind of just worked year over year to try to build partnerships and make his case for abolishing the slave trade. But it took a long time. It took many years. And there was a lot of time that had to go by for him to make his arguments to try to change people's minds and hearts along the way. And when you're going up against a cultural value or a cultural moray of this is what's acceptable and this is what we do, it's making that case takes time. And so, you know, that was sort of the incremental approach of William Wilberforce. And, you know, I think that there is a lot in the pro-life conversation that they often compare what they are doing. They will often argue from analogy to matters of slavery, especially when you start talking about defining a person and human dignity. And, you know, we used to think slavery was okay, and now we don't. What's your standard for that? So the connection between the modern pro-life movement or the abolitionist movement and William Wilberforce is not an it's not an unfair or strange or random analogy. There is definitely some connecting thoughts between the two movements. Okay, we're going to skip ahead a little bit in the conversation and pick it up, and then we'll come back and comment on it.
The means. And look, I understand. I mean, no one is supposed to be satisfied with incremental bills. That's the whole point of it being incremental. It's called incrementals because you're trying to gradually get to where you want. Yeah. So right. No one should be satisfied right. by these bills. We can rejoice. Yeah. We can rejoice that we are progressing mm-hmm. and saving newborn babies. The same way that Wilberforce, he did not want to simply end the slave trade. He didn't simply want to say, hey, you can't sell the trade, but it's okay to keep the trade. That's not what he wanted. He wanted to say, no, you can't sell people. Sorry, trades. You can't sell slaves nor keep the slaves. But he did not. He wanted to ban all slavery. Mm-hmm. But he still rejoiced when the slave trade ended. Mm-hmm. Because then, finally, one major part was finished. Now he could move on to focusing on banning slavery as a whole, which is what we want. What we want is, we're going to rejoice when we can save babies who are past 7-8 weeks, right, with the heartbeat bills, or even before that with the three or four weeks. But we also then want to work then after we pass some of these bills to attempt to save babies, all babies, with zero exceptions. But unfortunately, our abolitionist friends, and I will call them friends, but they wouldn't call us friends. They'll call us enemies, many of them anyways, because they believe that we are just as bad as, unfortunately, the abortion advocates. And some of them really do say, in fact, some of them say that we are even worse yeah. than the abortion advocates.
Yeah. Okay. So that, I think, is a good kind of overview of the issue. Now, Natalie's got a great comment here. She says, one reason they got to that point, and I think she means they as in the abolitionists, abortion abolitionists, got to the point of kind of this all or nothing kind of black or white thinking, is that the step-by-step politicians or the incremental approach do very little to ban abortions, but still want to be called pro-life since they are doing something. And I think that's a fair point. I think that I have often felt frustration, you know, that more progress isn't being made in terms of laws and policies. And I would have to think more about whether or not the solution to that problem is to get into these more, you know, kind of black or white bills. Now, that's still an issue I'm kind of thinking through. Elaine's asking a question. Did the slavery argument ever include legal consequences comparable to a mother seeking abortion? Well, I think it depends on what laws were being passed. I mean, eventually, yes, owning a slave or trading a slave became illegal, and that came with legal consequences if you were found to be doing that. So yes, eventually that came to be true. Now, I had a conversation with Sam over dinner about a year and a half ago, and we discussed the issue of incrementalism a little bit. And I know that he is a pretty solid proponent of that as a strategy of trying to lobby for laws incrementally and trying to save as many babies as we can. And personally, I find myself sympathetic to the incrementalist approach. As we continue, though, to engage in active conversation and doing some of the things like Kristen Hawkins and others do to try to help educate people and push back and stand out there sometimes on college campuses and have people scream at you and call you names and do all kinds of horrible things to you. Because as we saw with William Wilberforce, the national conversation of changing minds and persuading people, that takes time. And that's really the best way for a law to become successful is, like in our own time or in our own country, you know, eventually enough people changed their minds about slavery that laws started to change here in our country as well. Eventually we fought a war about it, and we decided it was so important that we lost lives and treasure over the issue. So, you know, we would hope and pray as Christians for God's grace in that he would also be at work in those conversations and changing minds and hearts and persuading people as we're out there doing that. And personally, I'm sympathetic to this incrementalist approach as we are at the same time trying to persuade people. In fact, I've been an incrementalist for a long time. I wrote a editorial piece for the Biola Chimes all the way back in 1991, which is the student newspaper of Biola, advocating for incrementalism. So that's definitely like just strategically kind of where I fall. But I think that, Sam, it also makes a very important point of, you know, there's some parts of the conversation in the pro-life issue that I just honestly haven't thought about until recently. And that I can't say that I've ever like really sat down and thought about like the total end game of like, what is the end? I just always thought about it in my mind. Well, we just want abortion to end. We want there to be no more abortions. And I just didn't really have it all thought through. Natalie says, I don't agree with these abolitionists. Anything that decreases the number of abortions is helpful. We cannot be deceived into supporting those. Yeah, I mean, on the strategy part of it, of the all or nothing, I find myself more on the strategy side of incrementalism. But I do think, and I'm going to get to this in just a minute, that I do think that abolitionists raise some important points that, to be honest, I had not considered until recently. And so I think that we'll get to that. All right, another comment. Abortionists don't let the mother see or hear the ultrasound before they do the abortion. Heartbeat bills are not enforced because the abortionist says there is no heartbeat. Those bills are worthless. I can't speak to that. I don't know about the implementation. I'm not an expert on that issue. Elaine says incremental laws can lessen the carnage while giving time for the law to become a teacher to the culture. It makes you think about it. Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay. Now, Rachel is saying a very important comment. It all depends on how you define your terms. I would call myself an abolitionist. And Kristen Hawkins makes that same point in the interview where she said, well, sometimes I call myself an abolitionist, but in that stream within the pro-life movement, they would say she is not an abolitionist. And we're going to get to why that is. Okay. Let's talk about the other component of the abolitionist point of view and kind of some really important points that abolitionists make that I think is important for us to think about. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the conversation to that.
They want people to be born, right? They are truly anti-abortion. The problem is their ideology suggests it is truly better if it's nothing instead of some people being saved. To be honest, it's attractive because no one should be satisfied with incremental bills, right? No one should be. There's a lot of frustration that things aren't better than they are. Now, we pro-life people would say that's true, right? We recognize that we all want things to be better. So I think since they genuinely do want things to be better, I think a lot of people have just grown impatient and are starting to see faults with the people historically. The only people historically who've been fighting against abortion. Beyond the typical kind of frustration and patience, I think the pro-life movement has a legitimate, needs legitimate thinking or rethinking on certain things. But I think, you might disagree with me on this, and that's fine. I think it's good for self disagreements. But as I said in the article, I might say it's good for us to have this disagreement. It's good for us to talk about disagreements. But I think, a lot of people grow, impatient and frustrated when a lot of pro-life people refer to all women who get abortions or who have abortions as being victims. I would say that's just not true. The only victim, at least, again, generally speaking, the only victim is the preborn baby. And I think that makes a lot of people upset, and I think rightly so. But unfortunately, a lot of the abolitionists who get upset by that, they then assume false motives on the pro-life movement as a whole. Because then they believe, well, if you believe that the women who are killing babies are victims, then you're my enemy, right? Then they think in their minds is the same kind of arguments that the pro-abortion people say as well. So I think in my mind, the pro-life movement needs to, move away from the women who have abortions being victims thinking, and also. Again, I said this in the article, so I know it's controversial to many people within the pro-life movement, but I think it's unhelpful that if we do believe that abortion should be illegal, if we believe that abortion is murder, but then we don't believe that women or anybody who perform or facilitate an abortion should receive, criminal charges for that. Now, of course, in various degrees, depending on the case. If we believe that's wrong, well, I think that's problematic, right? Because if killing a baby is just like killing a 5-year-old person, then I think then we need to say then that people who have abortions, then once abortion is illegal, should be penalized for that.
Okay, so here is where Sam is making the case for those in the mainstream pro-life community that he says, hey, look, abortion abolitionists have a good point here. Like, maybe we need to rethink some aspects of how we are framing up the argument. Because once again, if the argument goes, abortion is the murder of an innocent preborn human life, and again, I'm defining murder in a very particular way. I'm defining murder as the unjustified killing of an innocent human life. And if we are saying that abortion is murder, and murder is morally wrong in all other cases, and we prosecute for murder in all other cases, but we're creating a special case, a special circumstance where we do not prosecute for murder. And there, I think the abolitionists are highlighting an inconsistency. And so this is why they want to make the case to prosecute those mothers who murder their preborn children. Now, the argument for criminalizing abortion in the case of criminalizing it, like, I think we could all quickly agree, like, eventually pro-life people ought to want to see the criminalization of abortion when it comes to the doctors, or I would even go so far as people who sell chemical abortions and that sort of a thing. But the argument for criminalizing abortion in the case of the mother is a very controversial idea. But if you think about it, abortion implies forethought, intention. They drove to the clinic, they made the appointment, they signed a paper of consent, and then they go through with the procedure. Or in the case of a chemical abortion, you placed an order, you used your credit card, and then you took the pill. I think that Sam is trying to highlight, hey, you know, there's an aspect of our argument that we are sharing in common with the pro-abortion community, and that is kind of the woman is 100% a victim in this situation. And he's just trying to say, you know, I'm not sure that that's the best way to think about this. Natalie says, the argument I have heard is that if women were prosecuted for having abortion, they would not have an abortion. Well, we could certainly say it's a deterrent. I mean, obviously, capital punishment doesn't keep everybody from killing someone, but it probably keeps a lot of people from killing someone or taking an innocent human life. So, you know, the issue of deterrent, I think, is a fair point to bring up. All right. Now Natalie's raising my very next point. She says, however many women are pressured into abortions. So it seems unfair because often the woman does not want to have the abortion. So in that case, many abolitionists would say, no, in that case, a woman should not be coerced into an abortion. And if that's the case, like let's say it's in a human trafficking situation or that sort of a thing, or a woman who's coerced by her parents or her boyfriend, then the person who, you know, she might be, you know, and this is where we would have to debate like first degree murder versus manslaughter. But the person who does the pressuring or the coercion could be criminally responsible. I don't know what, Natalie, you're a lawyer. I don't know what the right word is there, but they may be, you know, on the hook legally in some way as the coercive party. And if the person is in a human trafficking situation where they don't even seem to have, you know, much of a will in play at all, they might be found, you know, they might not even be prosecuted. So that is, yeah. And you're saying exactly what I'm saying, Tracy, is that the men involved would be liable for conspiring in the murder, or the mother of the woman who's pregnant. Sometimes mothers pressure their own children to do abortions. So if it was a coercive situation, and there's, again, where the law would have to adjudicate whether it was a first degree situation or second degree or manslaughter or whatever. Now, another common question that comes up, well, first of all, I want to say clearly that many of the abolitionist people are not saying criminalize all abortions willy-nilly for all women in all times and all places. They make allowances for not prosecuting on coercion, but we would have to adjudicate what type of murder that might be or whether they wouldn't be prosecuted at all. So there is some allowance. They're not being so crazy as to say, like, you know, just indiscriminately, women are 100% always responsible. Another common question is, well, if we criminalize this, then would that mean going back in time and prosecuting past abortions? And that doesn't seem to be, from my understanding, what most abolitionists are advocating. It's just like any other law of, you know, from this point forward, here's what we're doing. And going back to the point of coercion, according to statistics, coerced abortions do constitute a fair number of abortions. Like that is a very real issue. Okay. Now let's listen to Kristen's response to what Sam just said.
It was a lot. And you certainly did say something a lot of people disagree with, especially when you talked about penalties for and seeking criminal punishment for women who've undergone an abortion. I would say that view is largely opposed to about 95% of the pro-life movement in America, who says, you know, we can't offer a helping hand one day and slap women with penalties the next. So I think that, you know, I think you're right in that there are always going to be, and there are women today, any of us know, who have gone out to pray in front of an abortion facility or sidewalk counsel in front of an abortion facility. There are women who truly do not know what it is they're doing. There's women who are so steeped in a crisis and have a tunnel vision of the crisis of the pregnancy that they refuse to consider any other information about the development of their child, the fundamental, unique, whole human being living inside of them, who it was also created in the image of our God. But there are women who do know what abortion is and still choose abortion. I think, though, your policy prescription of, punishing women, of saying that you would be in favor of laws that criminalize women, I would deeply disagree with that, especially at a moment where you have for 50 years a country that has told women killing a child is okay, and in fact is empowerment. And because I don't know how you prescribe intent to women who seek abortions and say, well, you didn't know it was a child, you sort of knew, and you really knew. I think that becomes very legally problematic. And I think it's very difficult when you're faced with 50 years of a country that's told women and men and families that it's okay to kill their child, and then the next day say, no, you will now be put in jail for seeking abortion. I feel like it's much more of a educational moment, and almost, it's, I think it's a conversation for legislators.
Okay, she said a lot there. So let me make a few comments, and then we'll keep it going. But she basically has two responses to the abolitionist position, and correct me if I'm wrong. You can put it in the chat. But her first argument seems to be one based on pragmatism. It's impractical. Criminalizing abortion will confuse people. They don't know medically what the baby really is a baby. They've bought into the lie of it's just a clump of cells, and it would just really be impractical and confusing to people. That seems to be sort of her first rejoinder. Personally, I don't find this to be a very compelling argument, but persuasion can be very personal. So someone else may find that argument persuasive. I do not. When the Supreme Court said that gay marriage was now fell under the Equal Protection Clause in 2015, things changed pretty quick. People changed their minds and their policies pretty quick. And, they knew they had to conform. When Roe was overturned, things changed pretty quickly. There was a little confusion initially, but within weeks, things started to become more clear, and states passed laws, and because basically the Supreme Court was sending it back to the states, and the states sorted themselves out. And I'm kind of a skeptic that it would be that confusing. You know, if the court came down and said, no, it's a human person, and it also deserves equal protection. And I think that there would be some confusion initially, but people would wrap their minds around it pretty quickly because they don't want to go to jail. Now, I'm not suggesting that they would agree with it, that their heart posture would necessarily change very quickly. But I think I disagree with the position that people would be so confused and they wouldn't know what to do. That's an opinion. Now, I think that Sam, at some point, I don't know if we're going to hear it or not, but at some point in the interview, I mean, he admits, like, we're a long ways off from being able to get rid of all abortion, including chemical abortion, and criminalizing it. Like, this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow or next week or next year, unless the Lord intervenes. But I think that the principle of criminalization as an eventual end goal, it is logically consistent with, if we truly think that abortion is murder, then why are we creating a special category of murderers that we do not prosecute? that's a little peculiar. Like, can we have that conversation? It is the logical outcome of the moral principle would seem to be criminalization. Now, again, we're not saying that's going to happen overnight. We're not saying, we're saying we still have to have a lot of national conversation. But I think the abolitionists are right to point out that people who were working to end the transatlantic slave trade, their goal was not simply to end the transatlantic slave trade. Their goal was to get rid of all slavery, period, in the UK. All right. And eventually we had our own wrestle with that conversation in our country. Because we believed in the moral principle that it wasn't right to kidnap humans and force them into servitude. Like, that's not right. Well, how did we get that standard? We look in the Bible. That's how we get that standard. Likewise, we say that every life has dignity. Well, where do we get that standard? Sure, you could make some kind of natural law argument, but eventually, if you work natural law all the way back to its source, we're looking at something resembling the Bible, okay? So we're a long ways off from that. But, you know, I think that in principle, people in the pro-life conversation need to think about what is the end goal? Like, what is it that we are trying to accomplish here? Kristen's second argument seems to be kind of an appeal to compassion. Mothers are already going through enough of a struggle. The pro-life community and sidewalk counselors are having a hard enough time convincing women not to kill their preborn children. Talking about criminalization and criminalizing laws, that's going to make our jobs even harder to stand for the preborn. And so, again, it's sort of a practical argument. It's kind of also an appeal to compassion for the mother. And I can see this argument. I think this one has a little bit more weight for me, but I think I'm like Sam in that I am both. And is it possible, like, someone's going to come on my comments and they're going to come for me? But, like, can I be an incrementalist who works toward abolition and criminalization? Like, is that a thing? Because I think strategically incrementalism could be good, but I also understand the frustration with lawmakers who only seem to be giving lip service to the pro-life community. And it doesn't seem like they're very hard, and so a lot of them seem very soft. And you know, it's like, I want somebody who's really going to fight for the preborn. And so I get that frustration. But, you know, criminalization isn't going to happen now, but can we pray for that? Do we need to think about having that conversation within the pro-life community? Do we need to rethink some things about the ultimate goal? So, I don't know, some things to think about. All right, let me continue and pick up the conversation.
To have, certainly, and they have every right to have that conversation, but I think that's a conversation that comes decades later after our culture is truly changed.
I think the issue with that, though, is that I think it's inconsistent with our with a lot of what we believe as pro-life people, in that we believe, for example, that abortion is a very similar issue as the slavery issue. A lot of people, from the very beginning of the world, have been told that slavery is okay. For the first 200 years in American history, Americans have been taught, especially in the South, that Black people were subhuman and that it was good to own them as slaves. And yet when slavery, of course, to the Civil War and everything else, we know, but when it was banned, anybody owned slaves, they'd be charged for owning that slave, right? Even though they had been conditioned for a long time to think less of Black people the same way that for 50 years, which is even lesser than how long slavery was an institution, or at least as a legal institution, we still had punishment. So if we believe, as I do, that abortion is even worse than slavery, then I struggle with the argument that you laid out. But now, as you said, I do agree that
lots of good questions coming in on. I'm going to address a few of these. Let's see. Alexa says, I think it's the only logically consistent position. I think you're talking about abolition, the abolitionist criminalization component, but I wonder if advocating for that in this culture might make it impossible to make progress. And I think that that's kind of what I'm reading into Kristen Hawkins' concerns, is that, hey, if we start talking about criminalizing this, like, that's going to really hurt our cause. That's impractical. It's going to make an already hard conversation even harder. And that's where we get into the strategy part of it. On the other hand, I will say that the abolitionist position is that people stood against slavery even when it was the very small minority position. And they had to at least start standing for the correct moral principle as they were trying to change laws and persuade people in the cultural conversation. And so the abolitionist rejoinder to that is, I don't shy away from something simply because it's controversial. Rather, I stand on principle and help explain the fully orbed, true pro-life position by explaining the principle of I believe that abortion is murder, and murder is defined as the unjustified killing of an innocent human life. And so at some point, you have to start standing for the thing, even if the thing is a very small minority position. And that's what they had to do for the slavery abolitionists, and abortion abolitionists would say we need to stand on principle too. All right, Karen is asking, is there a difference in the way incrementalists and abortionists or abolitionists think about the laws related to IVF? That's a big conversation in my state right now. Ooh, buddy, is it? Alabama is trying to figure themselves out, and I think the nation as a whole. And boy, we're starting to see how many conservatives really are inconsistent in their pro-life position and don't really seem to understand IVF technology. And our friend Katie Faust has been pounding that drum on Twitter recently. And I think today she called out Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, on the issue. And there was somebody else, some big Republican the other day who was like, you know, I think it was Carrie Lake, who's kind of, you know, pretty conservative. I think she's trying to run for Senate or something in Arizona, but she was extolling, you know, IVF, and she's a big pro-life person. And so I think the abolitionists would absolutely want to get rid of most uses of IVF technology, or at least drastically control how it's used. And in a very tiny minority of cases, would it be applicable? But, you know, I don't see a lot of energy about IVF within the pro-life community. Now, I could be wrong about that, but to me, that just seems like it's a total side conversation. And that's something that I've been speaking out about for almost 30 years now. But because pastors don't counsel properly a lot of times, they've never had a class in medical ethics. I don't know what the issue is, but I have a massive ethical problem with IVF, and I think abolitionists do too. All right. Yeah, Natalie, you're absolutely right. IVF creates humans and then they are frozen. So if we're going to be consistent, the life begins at conception. We can't be freezing and throwing away life. Like, that's not consistent with the pro-life position. So, all right. All right, let me play a little bit more, one more minute of this, and then I think that will be it.
Yeah, there are different kinds of pro-supportive people. And that's why I think those are different kinds of laws for people who kill others, right? I think, you know, you have first degree, you have second degree, third degree manslaughter. And it's, you know, intent is hard to prove, but I think sometimes, I mean, that's true for every kind of murder, right? But that's why you have trials. That's why you have all these things. It's very hard to hear these things, but I think if we do believe, now I'm not saying that this should be happening right now, But I think once abortion has become legal, completely with zero exceptions, anybody who breaks the law should be punished for that. I don't think people who kill babies should be
I think it's, exception. I mean, that's a very complicated, I mean, you brought up the issue of slavery. The question, though, is also, was anyone ever forced to have a slave? Many people, many women are forced to have abortions. And I think it's very different when you look at that. I also think it,
which again, we already said, most abolitionists have provisions for coercion. So maybe Kristen isn't aware of that, but what she's raising here, in my opinion, is a straw man. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt. She just probably isn't aware that most abolitionists want to allow for exceptions for coercion. And that the coercion itself should be criminalized. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead here.
A decision of abortion going back to the states. But now we have 50%, soon probably 75% of abortions are going to be chemical abortions. So even in the red states that will move to immediately make abortion illegal or mostly illegal, you're still going to have women getting abortion drugs from California and from New York being shipped in. We still have...
Correct. And abolitionists would say, yes, we want to outlaw that too. And I'm not seeing too much energy in the pro-life community about the whole rise of chemical abortions. We're going to be doing a whole show about that in a few weeks. We're having our friend Dr. Chris come back on. She's an obstetrician, gynecologist, and she's going to come break down all of the forms of birth control and also talking about chemical abortions because that's something that she's really looked into. But yeah, abolitionists would be against that as well.
Have a society that tells her that she can't, that she's not, despite all the feminist rhetoric, that she's not strong enough to choose both, to choose herself and the life of her child. And so I think there's a lot more of work that we would have to do before society would ever even get to that moment, because we're not close to abolishing abortion. The abortion landscape is shifting, and it's going to be taking place in a toilet bowl near you, not at the abortion facility down the street. But it's certainly not going to, what's going to happen with the Dobbs decision is certainly not going to eradicate abortion across the country.
Exactly. And I think that the pro-life community is going to have to shift a little bit in how we're having the conversation, because even in those states that have heartbeat laws now, the abolitionist is sounding the alarm that, like, please stop citing these numbers that, like, abortions have been eradicated after 6 weeks in the entire state. No, they haven't. Only in abortions that you go walk into. But chemical abortions are still a thing. And, you know, as Kristen very crassly puts it, abortion is just changing locations and it's going to be done at home. And so we need to not just get caught up in congratulating ourselves, you know, about the heartbeat bills. We need to keep moving, keep pressing the cultural conversation and the legal conversation. But even though, like Kristen said, we're a long ways from criminalizing, I think that the abolitionists raise a very important point that we still need to stand on principle. And just as they did for slavery, we're going to stand on principle now and not worry about, hey, we're a long ways from this. Let's not even talk about it. No, we're a long ways from this, and we can talk about it, and just like the abolitionists of slavery did. Okay, anyways, I hope this helps give you a little bit of an introduction to the differences between the standard pro-life position and the rising abolitionist position. I would welcome you to send your feedback. What do you think? What questions do you still have? And... Karen says, I was disappointed when the Alabama Supreme Court decision defining embryos created by IVF as fully human was immediately derailed by laws passed by our state legislators. Yeah, it's they got caught of like, you know, we're being very inconsistent in how we are defining a human. One other thing I wanted to bring up that I was thinking about that they did not bring up is the question of abortion, a case of rape and incest. There's a, you know, a portion of the pro-life community that advocates for that position. And they'll say, well, you know, we'll save most of the babies because, you know, rape and incest is only about, I think, maybe 3% of the abortions. I question that number, especially with the high levels of coercion and human trafficking, but be that as it may. I think that the abolitionists raise a very thoughtful point of, you know, well, why are you punishing an innocent human life and again, creating a protected class of murderers, those who have endured rape and incest? You know, we need to rather focus on punishing the rapist and punishing the person committing the incest. Like, we need to be more aggressive in our prosecution of those people. But why would we, you know, kill an innocent human person to receive, you know, this horrible fate of not existing? It just doesn't seem like that principle is consistent. And so, you know, that's something that I think President Trump, President Reagan, both advocated that position of, you know, the exceptions of rape and incest. But if we're going to be consistent, we have to think about that, you know, in a very thoughtful and careful way. All right. And you're right, Natalie. That's a much more elegant way of saying what I'm trying to clumsily say is that would be saying those babies are not worthy of life because of how they were conceived. When we think about our friend Ryan Baumberger that we had on the show about a year and a half ago and talking about his story. And, you know, he really was a child. He was a child conceived in rape, but he gives so much credit to his birth mother for not aborting him, bringing him to life so that he could be adopted into a family. And so rather than focusing all the attention on the rapist, he focuses the attention on what a hero his birth mother was to bring him to term. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. But, you know, I would love to see more prosecutions and more energy in the conversation of like, well, let's go after these rapists. Who are these rapists that are causing women to get pregnant and then forcing them or coercing them to get abortions? Like, we should be going after those people. So, all right. I hope you found this helpful. I know it's a little over time. Sorry about that. I didn't manage my time very well. But I look forward to your feedback and your comments. And again, send me your feedback if you felt like I was unfair or I got something wrong. That'll be great. And I'll incorporate that into future discussions. Thank you so much, everyone. Bye-bye.